We shall continue with our Nidhamma talk from yesterday, and the topic thus is still Satipatthana. And so the establishment of mindfulness, and yesterday we explained the qualities of sati, and in particular the definition of sati. And do you remember what was the characteristic of mindfulness? This is what we discussed towards the end of the talk. Yes? Yes, non-superficiality, meaning that the mind, when it's observing the object of observation, should not skim over the surface of the object, but rather sink into the object. And then, what was the function of mindfulness? Do you remember this too? Pardon?
To protect?
No, that's the manifestation. That's the first manifestation. Or the second one, sorry. Yes, a non-forgetfulness, or in other words, keeping the object in view. And then, as for the first manifestation of mindfulness, what is this? Yes, that's the second one. Pardon me? Being face to face with the object, yes indeed. Or to put it differently, confrontation, a state of confrontation, confronting the object. And the protection of the mind is the second manifestation of mindfulness, and through this moment-to-moment mindfulness in a very continuous manner, the unwholesome mental states have no chance to arise in the stream of consciousness, and as a result of this, the mind is protected. It's protected against the defilements. And as for the proximate causes for the arising of mindfulness, there are two. And do you remember those two? The first one was concentration. Not quite. Effort. Well, indeed, efforts. If it's continuous, leads to the development of mindfulness. Yes, and apart from this, we talked about perception, strong perception of an object. So, if the perception of an object is clear-cut, then the mindfulness will also be clear-cut. And the second proximate or nearest cause for the arising of mindfulness lies simply in mindfulness, the four foundations of mindfulness. When you mentioned efforts earlier on as a cause for the arising of mindfulness, yes, it's correct, but it's not necessarily the nearest cause. So we have to distinguish between a proximate cause and nearest cause, and or nearest causes, and other causes that might lead to the arising of mindfulness. So saying the effort or citing effort is correct in a wider sense. Now, this mindfulness of ours that we need so much in the meditation, in the Vipassana practice, should possess a number of other qualities. And the first of these other qualities is immediacy. So as soon as an object has arisen, should the observing mind go towards the object of observation. And nothing should come between the observing mind and the object of observation. So one should not allow the mind to get on some irrelevant tangent, through maybe thinking or reflecting or analyzing or fantasizing and so on and so forth. And there should be no gap in time between the arising of the object and the arising of mindfulness. So this mindfulness should be present without, or should be with the object without any delay, instantly. And if mindfulness does not possess this quality of immediacy, then it may easily happen, an object arises, and only a couple of minutes later, or in a better case, a few seconds later, does one become aware of it. And in this situation, one is no longer aware of the present moment. So by the time the mindfulness reaches the object may already be gone. Not in all cases, but at least in some cases. Furthermore, our mindfulness should possess yet another quality. And so this is the quality of concurrence. Or to put it differently, the mind should be arising simultaneously with the object of observation. So there should be a certain synchronicity between the arising of the object and the arising of mindfulness. Again, if your object arises and only a few seconds later your mindfulness is on at the scene, then you won't be able to really know the nature of the object. So the mindfulness is lagging behind. And so to then give you an example for the concurrence of the mindfulness with the object of observation. When observing or studying the natural phenomenon of lightning, then you cannot, let's say the lightning is taking place now, and then half an hour later you try to find out what the lightning was all about. Now, is this going to work? It's not going to work. Obviously, it's the nature of the lightning to arise and pass away, or to cease within an extremely short period of time. So if you want to study this phenomenon of a lightning, then you have to be with the event as it is happening, as it is fresh and hot. So the same thing applies to the meditation practice. Then the commentaries to the Satipatthana Sutta and Mahasatipatthana Sutta point out a number of qualities that mindfulness should possess. And one of them is given in the Pali language as okantitova, which means entering into the object of observation. Now, this is not very different from the characteristic of mindfulness being non-superficiality, the sinking of the mind of the observing mind into the object. So whenever a predominant object has arisen, and while it's still going on, you want to enter this object as much as possible. Now, in practicing this Satipatthana meditation, we need to possess not an ordinary, usual type of mindfulness, average type of mindfulness, but rather we need an extraordinary kind of mindfulness. And if one were to do it in this practice, you know, with just an casual type of mindfulness, ordinary type of mindfulness, then one would not get very far. And some precious time would go by, but one would not really yield or gain substantial benefits from the practice. And the intensity of the practice should not be underestimated. Intensity is really important for a proper unfolding of the insight knowledges. So in this connection, we need extraordinary mindfulness and not ordinary mindfulness. Now, there are two Pali terms for this. One is visita, and the other is busata. And busata refers to the fact that the mindfulness should be excessive, it should be intensive and persistent. And so visita points to the fact that the mindfulness should be extraordinary or of an outstanding nature. Now, in the discussion of the Pali term satipatthana, we have to also look at the particle pa of the term satipatthana. And so the Buddha could have used the term satipatthana. However, he chose to use the term satipatthana instead. And the additional particle pa was inserted in order to bring across the meaning or bring across a special meaning of this mindfulness. So this particle pa, according to the commentaries, can be interpreted in various ways. It may signify different things. And these are all qualities that apply to our meditation, or that should be applied to our meditation practice. So the first interpretation of the particle pa is as pakkhandana, pakkhan or pakkhanditva pavatati. And in English, this means that one's mindfulness should rush towards the object of observation as soon as this object has arisen. And instead of rushing, we could also say the object, the mind should leap towards the object. It should plunge into the object. And when one of your family members suddenly falls sick, then you will not just have a big meeting, what to do, and then wait for 5 days, and then only call some, an ambulance. But in the case of an emergency, medical emergency, you will act promptly, you will rush, and you will rush towards the telephone, you will call an ambulance, and make it very clear that the ambulance should come as quickly as possible. So same thing goes for the meditation practice. Whenever an object has arisen, the mind should rush towards it without any hesitation, without much thinking, reflecting, and so on. And this word, the English word rushing, has different implications, and one of them is in the context of military action. So one uses the term rushing when one refers to capturing or arresting the enemy forces by a sudden attack. So this meaning too should can be applied to mindfulness. As soon as an object has arisen, the observing mind, the knowing mind, should try to capture this object. Now, in the book that I brought along yesterday to the Dhamma talk, namely entitled Satipatthana by the Venerable Bhikkhu Anālayo, he mentions this very fact that the Venerable Sādhu Upanita stresses this capturing an object by sudden attack, and he then goes on to say that in the field of dry vipassana meditation, namely a form of vipassana where one does not start out with the practice of the jhanas, that this kind of an intensity of one's mindfulness is necessary for progress in the practice. And this is this observation is quite correct. It is for this reason that as a meditator we need to be dynamic in the practice. We need to be active and alert and always so to speak on the ball, knowing what's going on. And it cannot be overemphasized that the mental defilements, in whatever form they may manifest, are quick to arise in the stream of consciousness if the mind is not protected through mindfulness. The more you practice, the more you will understand this. Maybe at the very beginning of a retreat, you may not see the point. You may not understand why it is so important to be dynamic. But later on, when the mind becomes, or your mindfulness becomes sharper and sharper, and you see deeper into the workings of the mind, then you will surely understand. Now, another quality meaning of the particle pa is that one's the mindfulness should grasp the object of observation or seize the object. This in the Pali scriptural language is known as upaganhitva pavatati. And in Asia, where rice cultivation is common, once one has planted the rice, then or planted the rice, the paddy, and then gradually this will grow, and then when the harvest time comes, the rice farmers, a rice farmer has to grasp one bushel of rice with one hand, and with the other hand holding a sickle, he or she has to cut the paddy. Likewise, in the meditation practice, when an object arises, then we should firmly grasp or seize this object. And so only then will it be possible to know its nature. Now, in the beginning of the practice, it is a common experience among the meditators that they manage to grasp only the coarsest among all objects. However, as one's meditation practice unfolds, the mindfulness certainly gets sharper, concentration also becomes stronger, and the wisdom deepens. With this, one then can perceive or understand more and more refined objects. And so, with further practice, eventually a meditator may then pick up extremely refined mental states, or to take it one step further, to even understand what is meant by consciousness. So, in the Vipassana meditation, it is a good idea to follow this approach of going from the from coarse objects to increasingly refined objects. Now, when practicing mindfulness, we need to our mindfulness need to possess yet another quality, and this is the quality of covering the object completely. This in Pali is known as patritva pavatati. Now, this certain particular quality can be best explained in the case, or with the help of the rising or falling movement of the abdomen. Now, as you will know by now, the rising movements, or for one rising movement to unfold, some time will pass. And so you may find that there is a beginning, a middle portion to it, and an ending portion, although of course this division is very arbitrary. And so, when observing an object like the rising and falling movement of the abdomen, then you do not want to limit your observation to just one part of it, but rather you want to cover the whole object. Now, having said this, a certain limitation needs to be mentioned. At the very beginning of one's practice, it will be somewhat impossible to know the very beginning, to know the very end of the rising and falling movement of the abdomen. And usually it's the beginning portion that is most predominant. So at that point it's enough to know this. Later on, the ending portion also becomes more predominant, and then again later on in the practice all three parts become predominant, namely the beginning, the middle, and the end of the object. Now, a point that has been mentioned already in the preceding at Dhamma talks many times is the continuity of mindfulness. This in the Pali language is known simply as pavatati. And so the illustration for this is, if you have some gaps between these tiles on the floor, then naturally dust and dirt will accumulate in the gaps. However, when the tiles are closely closely laid without any gap or gaps in between, then of course no dust, no dirt can accumulate there. The same thing goes for the mindfulness. If your mindfulness is of an intermittent, or has an intermittent quality, namely being present for a while and absent for some minutes, and then plenty of mental defilements can arise in the meantime. And so, once you've understood that the mental defilements bring suffering, then you will want to prevent this situation from happening, and thus you'll try to make your mindfulness as continuous as possible. Buddha has spoken of the three universal characteristics, and the first one is impermanence, anicca, the second one is suffering or unsatisfactoriness, dukkha, and the third one is anatta, meaning non-self. And this aspect of anatta comes up in one's meditation practice. While observing the rising falling movement or some other predominant object like a pain or some thought or whatever else it may be, a meditator will sooner or later understand or come to understand that formations arise of their own accord. So it's not I who is making the rising happening. It's not I or the ego or the self, you know, that makes the falling happen, or you know, that makes the pain go away. But rather, you know, it's just a certain, because of certain conditions, does your rising occur, because of certain conditions does the falling occur, and again because of other conditions does the rising or falling disappear. And the same thing goes for pains and aches and other objects. So in the practice, and a very profound, a very intuitive understanding of anatta will arise out of the practice. Now, when we do the practice, when we undertake the practice, it is important that we practice with an attitude that reflects this aspect of anatta. So instead of wanting to do the practice, instead of wanting to control or manipulate or interfere with what's happening, we should simply just observe whatever is going on. So we should observe with an attitude of non-self and or absence of a self, and just let the practice unfold by itself. If we practice with this kind of an attitude, it is so much easier to practice. Now, an example in this connection. When a meditator experiences plenty of pains and aches in the body, and on top of this, plenty of unwholesome mental states arise in the mind, the natural reaction is to do what? Posture. What else? Stop the meditation. Aversion, yes indeed. You have aversion towards your experiences. You will hate your pain. You will want to get the you will want to get rid of the pain. You will want to get rid of the difficult mental states. And this very much reflects an attitude of atta. One is trying to interfere. One tries to one is not accepting the situation for what it is. And if you keep doing this again and again and again, and you see it's not helping, so when you keep running with your head running into a wall, sooner or later you'll get the message that there is a wall and that this that this method is not working. Sooner or later this understanding will come, and then you'll change and you stop running into the wall. Same thing in the meditation practice. Once you get the point that it doesn't work to try to make the pain go away or the difficult mental states go away, then you will adopt an attitude of what was it? Zemayesh. Just accept. Is correct? Yes. My Hebrew teacher is in the back. So, then you'll just accept whatever is happening, And with this attitude adopted, you will find that you have again progress, So early on your practice was stagnating, now all of a sudden it's moving again. So keep this in mind. And so then when you practice with an accepting attitude, then things will move, and so then quite naturally, all the pains and aches and most of the difficult mental states, at least on a temporary basis, will disappear, and then plenty of wholesome mental states will arise instead. Apart from the qualities of mindfulness that we have or that have been mentioned so far, there are a number of other qualities that mindfulness should possess, and these are not necessarily mentioned in the commentaries. However, there is there's reference for them in the suttas itself. And so what I'm going to say now is based on Venerable Anālaya's book Satipatthana. So in the Majjhima Nikaya, in the Theragata, we find passages that clearly say that one's observation, one's type of observation, should be a calm and detached observation, no matter what the object is. And during the interviews, you will have heard me saying, well, observe whatever is happening with a detached attitude. And especially when you're observing some difficult mental state, and you're totally engrossed in it, you're involved in it, you're entangled in it, then the detachment is extremely important. And at that point, figuratively speaking, step back. Step back a meter or two or three. And try to pull yourself out of this tangle. Try to disentangle yourself from what is happening in the mind. And if you manage to do this, then it's so much easier to practice. Now, with regard to this calm type of observation, especially when one starts practicing, when one has overcome the first few difficulties, and wholesome mental states start to arise, one gets all excited about the practice. And again, this is a point where it's good to remember to calm down a little bit and just know the excitement or the enthusiasm for what it is, and to take this as a new object of observation, and to let it pass. When we look at meditators who do this practice successfully, then indeed those who practice with a calm and detached attitude are the ones who progress most quickly and most easily. We practice meditation. It's also helpful to understand that this mindfulness plays or fulfills an important preparatory role for the arising of wisdom. Now, wisdom has been mentioned many times during the previous Dhamma talks, and that's what we're aiming for, trying to bring or bring, trying to let wisdom unfold, let the different insight knowledges unfold. And this is possible only if mindfulness is present. Without mindfulness, this would be quite impossible. With reference to the Anguttara passages from the Anguttara Nikaya, the Theragata, and the Majjhima Nikaya, it certainly can be said that mindfulness should give full and continuous attention to a matter. So instead of saying a matter, we can say mindfulness should give full and continuous attention to the presently arising object, whatever the object may be. So sometimes what happens in the meditation practice is, and it's a very common experience, a meditator sits there observing the rising and falling movement of the abdomen or some other object, and part of the mental activity is geared towards or is busy thinking about some totally unrelated matter. So you're sitting there observing your pain, and then you're thinking about what you're going to do after the retreat. Now, these two things obviously don't go together. And so, obviously, the mindfulness as well as the concentration is split over two objects. And as a result of this, you won't be able to give 100% of your mindfulness, 100% of your concentration to one object. Since you're not able to do this, you won't be able to clearly see the nature of the object in great detail. So it's good to have clear-cut experiences, and so this is possible only if you give full attention, if you practice with strong and balanced effort, if you give full attention to an object, and also you give full concentration to the objects under observation. Mindfulness has, or there are many different qualities to mindfulness, and yet another one comes in the context of the controlling faculties, or it comes in the context of the seven enlightenment factors. And who knows what this quality is? Quality of mindfulness. We have the five controlling faculties of faith, of effort, of mindfulness, of concentration, and wisdom. And so the five faculties can be grouped into two pairs. The first pair is the pair of effort and concentration, and the second one is that of faith and wisdom. And what about mindfulness? What does the mindfulness do? Yes, indeed. So, it's correct. The mindfulness in this particular situation, performs a balancing function. So it brings these two pairs into balance. And only when the respective pairs are of controlling faculties are well balanced will one continue to progress in one's meditation practice. And the same thing applies to the seven enlightenment factors. You can the seven enlightenment factors were mentioned yesterday. Mindfulness is one of them, and the other one, the others were wisdom, or investigation of states, the same thing. And then effort was there, or is there, joy, and then tranquility, concentration, and then upekkha, equanimity. And the first three, namely investigation of states, effort, and joy, form one group, and the remaining three, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity, form the second group. And it is mindfulness that brings about the balance of these two groups. And so the balance of the enlightenment factors is absolutely a prerequisite for the attainment of attainment or realization of Nibbana. And therefore, in the Abhidhamma, there is in the Abhidhamma we can find a statement that says certain. It is not good for certain mental factors, such as the controlling faculties or the enlightenment factors, to be excess. However, in the case of mindfulness, it can never be in excess. So, if your mindfulness has reached a certain level right now, this is good, but you should develop it further. So, strengthen it, you know, with every, you know, minute of your practice, with every hour, with every day of your practice. So, it will never hurt to have strong mindfulness. Passages from the Digha Nikaya and from the Anguttara Nikaya, yet another quality of mindfulness gets mentioned, namely that of restraining function. And this is very important in the connection with sila, with an ethical code of conduct. So, you're planning to do something, a certain intention arises in the mind, intention to take some food after 12 o'clock, or to take to drink some coffee at 5:30 instead of the light tea. And so when you're mindful of this particular intention arising in the mind, then you might understand, or you may pause and reflect, well, is this appropriate or not? And then you might come to the conclusion, okay, this would be against the precepts that I've vowed to take here and or observe here, and so you refrain from the activity. So mindfulness very much has a restraining function. If we're not mindful, then our behavior, especially when we when we're young, tends to be very impulsive. Other more modern expressions that are being used in the connection of mindfulness are the following. Some teachers speak of choiceless awareness. This is useful, and this refers to the fact that when you're in meditation and various objects come up, and then you just observe you observe whatever comes up without any preference, without a liking for this object and a disliking for another object. Yet another quality of mindfulness should be that it's non-interfering with what is happening. So you're observing a particular object like a pain, and so you try not to interfere in what is going on. You're trying not to manipulate, as we discussed earlier on, with what is happening, but rather you just observe what's happening. And so the approach of mindfulness, of satipatthana, is one of a detached observation of whatever arises without getting involved. And this approach differs, for instance, from the approach taken in modern psychology, or from an approach taught maybe 100 or 150 years ago, when parents would teach their children, please do not act out your anger, don't show it, don't act on it. And so modern psychology, some forms, not all, one particular form encourages the person to act it out. And so in Vipassana meditation, we do neither of them. Neither do we suppress certain objects, nor do we act on certain objects. Now, please let me limit this statement by saying that this applies to just mindfulness itself, the function or quality of mindfulness. It is a different story when it comes to the mental factor of effort. And effort, virya, has, or it is with effort that we abandon the unwholesome mental states, and it is with effort that we encourage or develop the wholesome mental states. And so this is based on several suttas in the collection of discourses. So the work of mindfulness is to simply observe whatever is happening. And if, for instance, an unwholesome mental state has been well observed, the nature of it is clear, and you know it's unwholesome, then effort can come in, and so with effort you then try to, or you then abandon the object. Now, for the sake of completion, it's worth mentioning some of the qualities of mindfulness in terms of the Abhidhamma. Now, mindfulness, from your understanding, is what? A wholesome mental state, or an unwholesome mental state, or a neutral, an indeterminate mental state? What do you think? Mindfulness itself. Neutral. So we've got one answer here. Neutral and
wholesome.
Obviously, absolutely, it's wholesome and it's not neutral. And mindfulness arises only. It is one of the so-called 19 beautiful and universal mental states, and which are invariably present in all beautiful consciousness. So it goes without saying that this mindfulness does not arise in connection with unwholesome mental states. And so whenever anger is there, mindfulness is not there. Whenever greed is there, mindfulness is not there. And however, we can then bring mindfulness to this particular constellation in the mind. As we've discussed already earlier on, there is a certain connection between effort and mindfulness, and there's also a connection between mindfulness and concentration. And when you look at for instance, the Eight Noble Path Factors, then you will find that among the last three factors, the first one is effort, samavayama, right effort, followed by right mindfulness, samasati, followed by right concentration, samadhi. And when we look at the five controlling faculties, we find exactly we find a similar order, namely, apart from the faith, effort then is mentioned, mindfulness is mentioned, and concentration is mentioned. And so what happens is, when a meditator is mindful from moment to moment to moment, over a longer period of time, then gradually the mind will fall squarely onto the object of observation, and it will be fixed to the object of observation. And so when this happens, concentration arises. The mind will be unified. So there is a connection between mindfulness and concentration. The mindfulness does lead to the arising of concentration. And the arising of concentration is not limited to only the practice of the jhanas, but mindfulness does arise in the context of the Vipassana meditation. And here it is known as momentary concentration, Kanika Samadhi in the Pali scriptural language. Now, maybe this much for mindfulness and the different qualities that mindfulness possesses or should possess. There are certain passages in the discourses that highlight the importance of the meditator or of the person to see the disadvantages of the sense pleasures, the so-called kama gunas in the Pali scriptural language. And it is only when one sees these disadvantages of the sense pleasures quite clearly that one can then progress along the path. So this second part of the talk will be devoted to these sense pleasures. Obviously, sense pleasures exist. We go to the movies, we see a movie, and we feel satisfied. A certain amount of pleasure is there. Or we've lived in some remote place, and so for quite some time, several months or so, finally we have an opportunity to go to a big city, and then eat an ice cream, and there's sense pleasures in this, right? And there are many other sources for sense pleasures. And sense pleasures arise in connection with the seeing process, in connection with the hearing process, in connection with the smelling process, and the tasting process, and the tactile process, and also with regard to the mental process. And the existence of these sense pleasures cannot be doubted, absolutely not. However, indulging in sense pleasures will have certain consequences, or can have certain consequences, and the Buddha warns against the consequences. And so he points out the character of these sense pleasures. Now, let's say you eat your ice cream, you derive a certain pleasure from it, and will it last forever? Will it last for a year or two? It will not. And so, unfortunately, because it does not last.
Every day.
Ah, see, there you go. Yeah, because it doesn't last that long, the next day, there's again a craving for an ice cream. And so, one character or one quality of these sense pleasures is that they are transient in nature, they are evanescent. So they come and they go. And not only this, once we have tasted a certain sense pleasure, then we want more of it, or if we have more of it, we might get bored with it, and then we crave for something else. So a new or different experience. And the Buddha further points, or the Pali for the point that has been mentioned is sabbe kama anicca. So anicca means impermanent, kama are your sense pleasures, and sabbe means all sense pleasures are transient. And the Buddha points to yet another character of these sense pleasures by saying that they are of no real taste. So it's a rather hollow taste. And so, and this in the Pali language is known as appasada. These sense pleasures do not give any permanent satisfaction. So it would be nice if we would have one ice cream and then the satisfaction lasts for a long period of time. But it simply just doesn't do this. And the happiness that we derive from these sense pleasures, according to the Buddha, is just a deception, or, again in his words, is just a dream. And when a dreamer awakens from it, then he does so, he or she does so, with sorrow and regret. And to bring this whole matter to a point, the Buddha has made the following statement: even though the pleasure is great, the regret is greater. So when you think of all the suffering that you have to undergo in order to watch a movie, you have to work in order to make some money, then to pay for the entrance ticket, and then you have to, if you don't have a car, you have to take a bus to go to the movie theater, and then you have to line up for maybe a long time, and then after watched the movie, then you have to take the bus again, and maybe the bus is not coming on time, so then you have to wait again for a long time, and so on and so forth. And by the time you get back home, you are totally tired and exhausted.
Finally, it's a bad movie.
And then it's even a bad movie. And it's not what you expected it to be. I don't know. Pardon me? And then you sleep in the bus. You miss the the stop where you should get off, and your suffering is even greater. So please, without going any further into other details, there are many sense pleasures around. And as unenlightened human beings, as non-anagamis, and anagami is a person who has gained the third level of enlightenment. And with this, with this experience comes the eradication of greed, craving, lust, desire, liking, wishing, and so on and so forth. So, as long as we're not anagamis, we will crave for these sense pleasures in one way or another. The more we practice, the less we crave, and the less we suffer. And when we don't practice at all, it seems the most natural thing to do to indulge in these pleasures. And this is what the world is all about. So if we live in a big city, there are a thousand and one advertisements for this and that, and offers and distractions and whatnot. So we grow up with all of this, and so we think it's the most natural thing to indulge in this. However, when we start practicing, then be it Buddhist meditation or something else, eventually we come to understand that there are other forms of happiness or pleasure around. And just the taking and observance of the precepts itself, according to, or in the words of the Buddha, leads to an unblemished form of happiness. So when you recollect your purity, when you recollect that you are not harmed, that you haven't harmed another being through killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct and whatnot, then happiness happiness can arise. And this kind of happiness is very different from the happiness or pleasure, or the happiness that you get from indulging in the sense pleasures. Furthermore, when you restrain your senses, as you're doing most of the time here on retreat, then after a while, you find that after all, well, this restraint of the senses isn't so bad. The mind tends to calm down and a certain amount of happiness arises. So again, the Buddha has pointed to just this, and he said this too brings about a form of happiness. And to make this even clearer, if you spend a whole day in a big city like Tel Aviv, or maybe downtown New York, Manhattan, and you walk through through the streets, and you hear all these, you hear the various kinds of sounds, the cars driving by, people talking, and sort of the music coming out of different shops and so on, and then there's the bombardment with various sites, advertisements, and so you see people, you see objects, material objects, and so on. Well, and there are plenty of different odors, and so on. And then, by the time you get back home, do you feel extremely refreshed after your day in downtown Manhattan, and absolutely happy? Do you? Yes, you do. So we have one person. So, at least our meditators in Lumbini, when after going to Bairoa and Sonoli, the next larger town nearby, and who are extending their visas in Sonoli, by the time they come back, they're so happy to be back in peaceful Lumbini, with less distractions around. Anyway, apart from this happiness that comes through the observance of precepts and the restraint of the senses, there are yet other forms of happiness around, and they arise when one starts meditating, and especially after some amount of practice, during the tender phase, the beginning phase of the fourth insight knowledge, the unwholesome mental states have been overcome, then a number of very pleasant mental states arise. Wholesome mental states arise, such as joy, and then there is tranquility and happiness. And these three together are known as Dhamma Rati or Dhamma Delight. Now, if you don't practice, you will not experience this Dhamma Delight. So you will not know what it's all about. But once you get there, you will find that there is a different kind of happiness or a different kind of delight available that is quite different or quite independent from the indulgence in sense pleasures. So it's different from your trip through downtown Manhattan. And so usually these three mental states of joy and tranquility and happiness arise, or they're not connected with some negative consequences, and so they arise out of a pure state of mind. Now, there is some pleasure, some happiness that arises when drinking a glass of wine. But when you have your second glass and your third glass, and then eventually you finish the entire bottle, and then you're even attempting a second bottle, by that time, where's the pleasure? Where's the happiness? No, you might end up for lying on the floor. And so there's certain disadvantages that go along with the indulgence in sense pleasures. However, if you indulge in joy, in tranquility, and happiness, then the only disadvantage, the only negative consequence is that you might stagnate in your meditation practice. But otherwise, certainly it's okay. Now, the Buddha has spoken of yet other forms of happiness, of happiness, wholesome mental states, joy, that arise out of the jhana practice, the samatha practice, mental development through through tranquility, through calm. And again, when one undertakes the samatha practice, one may experience very deep states of absorption that are very different from our ordinary experiences. Once you know this, you will understand how shallow sensual pleasures are, how shallow it is to indulge in these. And therefore, at that point, you will also understand, that, as mentioned earlier, that the sense pleasures have no real, or there's no real taste to them. It's a rather shallow, superficial taste. Now, when one continues with one's Vipassana practice and goes beyond the Dhamma delight, and one progresses through the remaining insight knowledges, then sooner or later the mind becomes very balanced, and so eventually one crosses over to the other shore. And so the experience of path knowledge, fruition knowledge will be there, and one will realize Nibbana. And with this, coming out of this experience, one will understand that the peace of Nibbana is by far better than anything else that one might experience in worldly life. And this peace of Nibbana is also referred to as Santi Sukha. Sukha meaning happiness, Santi meaning peace. So the happiness of peace. And so this happiness arises because of the total non-arising of formations. Because there is no seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking. So the mind is not bombarded by your sense impressions in downtown Manhattan. This is what the Buddha is trying to bring across, and it's so difficult to make people understand. that apart from these sort of ordinary, you know, or worldly sense pleasures, there are many other, or many better, things to go for. And these, the experience of Nibbana, is a utterly wholesome experience, even a life-transforming experience. And so, there are no negative implications or consequences to it. So you cannot get intoxicated with to maybe round up our Dhamma talk for tonight. Let me quote Dhammapada verse 186 and 87. Not by a shower of coins can sensual desires be saturated. Sensual desires give little pleasure and are fraught with evil consequences or negative consequences, dukkha. Knowing this, the wise man or woman who is a disciple of the Buddha does not find delight even in the pleasures of the devas, but rejoices in the cessation of craving. And with this, let me conclude today's Dhamma talk, and wishing that ultimately may you experience a type of happiness that by far excels all forms of worldly happiness. And this is it. Time for a few questions. Yes? Norm? Tranquility is? And the tranquility becomes an... Well, it might become an object for craving, indeed. And that's... for instance, in this phase of the practice that I referred to earlier on, at that point it becomes a problem. And so one wants to go back to the same experience again and again, and as a result of this, one's practice will stagnate. And so one needs to see this danger and then go beyond it and let go of the tranquility.
Another question is,
ask your question in Hebrew, and Gaudiya could translate. Speak on.
Yeah, he's asking how come we are concentrated on the most basic of all senses, which is the tactile impression and the sense of touch, in order to disconnect or detach yourself from the other sense further inside this sense of touch. Do you understand?
More or less. But please, Dolph, it's not... the observation of the rising and falling movement of the abdomen is one object, and so observing pain, so all of these are tactile objects, no doubt, but the instructions are not limited to just observing tactile objects. And you may recall that during the initial meditation instructions during the first evening, or on the first evening, I mentioned if you hear some predominant sound, so sound or the hearing becomes the most obvious object, well, then you observe this. The other sense doors are not excluded from the observation. Absolutely not.
And I mean, because I close my eyes, so I can't see.
Close your eyes, and yet you may have some internal seeing impressions, or you may see some images. And some meditators report they see images, they see colors, bright lights. The eye door is not closed in that sense. Of course, you are not seeing external objects, but internal objects are still available for for observation. Even with regard to the ear door, let's say you use earplugs, and so with the help of the earplugs, you manage to blend out what's the word for external sounds. Despite of this, you will still be aware of a number of internal sounds, like the brain is making certain noises, or there's the heartbeat, and so on. Okay, what else? Yes?
I want to ask about the attitude. If somebody will step on my foot, I won't say Zemayesh. I will leave. So Zemayesh, it's a bit problematic for me to live my life. Zemayesh. All my life I will stay in the same place, isn't it?
When the mind is filled with unwholesome mental states, such as greed, such as anger, and such as delusion, and so on and so forth, then indeed it's difficult to say Zemayesh. No, but if there's no more or very little greed, anger, delusion, pride and conceit, and so the restlessness and so on, then maybe you manage to say Zemayesh.
Yeah, but I think that the first step to Nirvana is to say this is not Zemayesh.
Well,
let's go further.
Okay, in that sense, yes. No, in that sense, I fully agree. So you don't accept. You don't accept the world for what's its usual for, or you don't accept what society tells you to appreciate, to hold in esteem. No, this is correct.
But if somebody threaten my life, threaten people around, threaten things that's important to me.
Sense pleasures come in. Okay. When you, and the Buddha clearly speaks to this, when our sense pleasures, in whatever form they come, when they are at a stake, and somebody is, somebody wants to remove them or they give us trouble, then we feel that we have to act. No? And out of wanting to defend one's sense pleasures, quarrels start, the arguments start, and even wars start. And so when one can see with wisdom that these so-called wonderful sense pleasures are in the end not worth fighting for, then you might find a different solution, in different from fighting.
No, I didn't say fight. I said that in the beginning, if somebody would step on my foot, I would say, just say, please, can you move your foot? Here it is like, okay, he's stepping on my foot. No. I said, can you please take off your foot?
Yeah, this man. Oh, this practice doesn't mean that you just accept everything that happens, there is, if I'm not mistaken, there is a nice illustration for this in Joseph Goldstein's book, A Case of a Snake That Was Taught to Be Nice, So one day somebody stepped on the snake, and then the snake complained to its snake charmer, saying, "Well, you've taught me not to not to react. But this person is stepping on me." And then the snake charmer said, "Well, but I didn't tell you not to hiss, or not." So hissing is okay. So if you Now, if you want to, if you want to ask this other person to maybe take his foot off your foot, then why not? There's one question in the back. Oh, could you speak up?
Can you explain what is mindfulness?
Explain what is mindfulness. The whole talk was on mindfulness. Yeah, mindfulness and awareness is the same. When mindfulness, maybe when I explained that early on, maybe it was misleading. Let's put it this way. When mindfulness is present at that, when strong mindfulness is present at that very moment, it's, even if it's just a short moment, the unwholesome mental states are not present. No, they have no chance to arise in the stream of consciousness. Now, from an Abhidhamma point of view, an unwholesome mental state may be present, like anger, and then eventually, when it's first there, mindfulness is not there, and then mindfulness is there. You notice the anger, and then maybe anger is back again, and then the mindfulness is there again. The anger is back again. The mindfulness is there again, and so on and so forth. So. See, the mind or consciousness is working at such great speed, and it's said in the text that millions, if not billions, of moments of consciousness arise and pass away in a single snap of fingers or blinking of the eyes, that very quickly does things change in the mind from, or can things change from one state to another, and as mindfulness gradually becomes stronger and stronger, the anger the moments of anger will subside until the anger is gone altogether. I can explain it. There's always a huge difference between the superficial perception of something and what really happens at the ultimate level. So, superficially, we may think that the anger and the mindfulness occur at the same time, simultaneously, whereas when we look very deeply, then we may find that anger and mindfulness may alternate. Yes?
How do you call it? Just observation?
Well, then you're observing it, yeah, sure. No, I know this. In terms of absolute, expressing things in an absolute way, of course, there is a certain inconsistency there. When practicing, it's so important to come as much as possible into the present moment, And so the anger that, or the example that we've been talking about, so there's a moment of anger, then there's the mindfulness, then there's another moment of anger, and then there's the mindfulness. And so, as much as possible, you try to see this. And if we look at the whole thing, let's say at this a level, then then we could say that actually the mindfulness is lagging behind just by a fraction of a mind moment.
One enjoy both
words.
Both.
Okay.
In India, go to Nikam and
Nagan.
Why can't you enjoy the same?
That's what I tried to try to bring across. No doubt, these these sense pleasures exist. People do do enjoy them, but there are certain disadvantages to them. In certain negative consequences.
I can't see them.
You can't see them.
I used to see them. Now I can't see them.
Well.
Yes, you can drink one glass of wine and turn into a whole bottle, two bottles.
Good. Okay. And what if... what was that with your husband?
No, I mean, you can love your job, you can hate your job, you can... You can choose. It's a planet of choices. You can choose your life. You can choose every day what to do. You can choose your state of mind.
Right.
You can choose everything. Why limit yourself to a monastery and just meditate all day?
What happened?
I'm
not wishing for anything, but what happens if your husband passes away and your children are no more? Then where's your joy?
Well, I find it. I know it's a possibility and it can happen. So I'm trying
not to. See, this is exactly what the Buddha.
This is not a reason not to have children, or this is not a reason not to. How will you know if you don't know first that it's good? How will you know something that's good if you didn't experience the
Buddha? The Buddha is trying to, trying to make people understand that there are even better things around. How to know? Meditate. No, we have a number of meditators here, who've had sex, who've children, and who then did the meditation practice and found that this is even more enriching.
Sure, but also the other side.
I'm not doubting.
Neither, but I'm sure you can also enjoy homework. As
long as you're getting your pleasures, then everything is okay. But when things are not happening the way you've chosen, the way you've selected, then life looks different. And
you choose everything.
Pardon?
The things that you think you don't choose,
Well. You choose everything, and then. But when you meditate, I don't want to get into a deeper discussion, but since you're pressing,
quantum physics says all what I said just now.
But I don't think it's talking about the I. So, see, this notion of a self there, I am choosing, I am selecting, I'm on top of life, this is a rather rather shaky thing. And meditate for 20 days or so, and then, or even within 10 days, you may find that this notion of an I that is deciding everything, that this is rather ephemeral. You think that you are choosing and that you are on top of your life, but in the end, things are happening quite differently. And so you'll see out of your meditation practice, hopefully, that there are plenty of cause and effect links or cause and effect relations that determine things. So when you think you are choosing, in the end it's just certain causes that lead to certain effects. No. Oh, you don't have to believe. Please don't believe me. And but do me one favor and continue with your practice. No. So, as mentioned earlier on, the perception of things at the surface oftentimes tends to mislead us. You know. And when we look, when we take a really closer look, I mean, we find that things are happening differently. So, please enjoy your worldly sense pleasures, but know the consequences. Know that the more attachment there is to another human being or to some material thing, the more sorrow will also be there. The more attachment you have to some being or some material item, the more fear might arise. No? Fear of losing it. And so these are major implications. No. Now you're smiling, but
because I had answers, but it's going to take forever, so we'll stop.
And so, by the time you experience Nibbana, your view of things will be quite different. No? Our views of the world change in the course of the practice. They do, very much so. Pardon me?
You have to go back?
Wait a minute. Say again. What was that with Nibbana now? She is in Nibbana now. That's your worldly Nibbana. No, but there's yet another kind of Nibbana, which is better than any kind of ice cream and better than other things. Okay, it's already 7:20. You have more burning questions? Well, we're beyond the time, so let's end for now.